Hi, everybody, and welcome to the finale of tonight's concert series. And I am Scott Dowd from arts-louisville.com. It's good to see you all here again, and welcome to our friends who usually come to the coffee concerts, and we're glad that you could make it out this evening and join us for this one. Of course, to my left, your right, Maestro George Mester, and we're very glad to have you here again. He's in his civvies tonight.
Yes, I didn't have time. How would he do? I didn't have time to change into my waiter's uniform. So I apologize for being so informal, but I'll be in my uniform for tonight, I promise.
And we're really glad to be able to say that we are having this final concert. Who would have thought a few months ago that we'd be here and that we'd have the season for next year? And we'll talk about that. You'll get plenty of notice about that in the months to come before September and Michael Feinstein and the Fanfara concert. But we're very, very glad to be able to be here this evening and to have this concert. And Maestro, tell us a little bit about the city. You're familiar with this area of the world.
The city.
The city that the concert is celebrating tonight.
The city that concert is celebrating tonight has nothing to do with the concert.
That's what I thought. That's why I thought I'd ask.
Originally, as you know, we celebrated several different cities during this whole season in order to highlight, in a way, the great music that these cities had either underwritten or helped create. We had St. Petersburg, we had Paris, we had... But we were going to do a beautiful piece this time by Frank Martin, a Swiss composer who wrote incredibly beautiful spiritual music. And we were going to do a work that was commissioned by the Zacher Foundation. And not only did he have a lot of money, but he commissioned tons of composers. Bartok wrote the music for strings, percussion, and celesta for him. It was, and so it was premiered in Basel. And so I thought that we could discuss Basel because we're going to do this Petite Symphonie Concertante, which calls for solo harp, solo piano, and solo harpsichord. But because of budgetary reasons, we're not able to do it. But we do have program notes. They were donated by this wonderful man who attended the pre-concert lecture here the last time. His name is Cody Galt. I don't believe he's here, is he? Oh, Cody, please stand up. Didn't you have a beard the last time I saw you? It was just the shadows. Anyway, thank you very, very much. Anyway, so so we can forget all about Basel because it has nothing to do with the program.
So let's talk about what is on the program for this evening, because it's a beautiful, beautiful arrangement. And we're going to start with a work from 1917 that was written in Italy. And about the fountains of Rome.
Well, it's a piece that, when I was a student at Juilliard, I was much too elegant to appreciate the piece. I thought it was cheapo. And so I always kind of denigrated the piece. But I played viola in the Juilliard Orchestra when we went on tour to Europe. And we played an outdoor concert in Rome in the middle of the night in one of those arenas, and we played the Fountains of Rome. And all of a sudden, smelling the pine trees and the beautiful moonlit night, I suddenly got it. And so I've loved the piece ever since. It's just an incredibly gorgeous piece. And in your program notes, there's a description of the four movements, so there's no need for me to bore you with them. Read the program notes. The one that I love the most is the second of the four movements, the Fontana del Tritone, which is a rather small fountain, and it's, I think it's some kind of a creature kneeling and playing a conch, yeah, And so it's a tiny, but you know, when you hear the four horns going at it in the second movement, it's unbelievable, you know. So you, all of a sudden you believe that this fountain is the largest thing ever built. And so there's also, one of the movements is, there's a beautiful word in Italian, tramonto, which is dusk. And when you think of dusk in Rome and see the fountain, I mean, it's the best. So, and it's cheaper than going there. So I think you'll enjoy this piece. If you've never heard it before, it is gorgeous. Gorgeous. Then, instead of the Frank Martin piece that we were going to do, and then our soloist was going to play the piano in, or the harpsichord, I forget which one. Since we couldn't do that, we asked him to do the Grieg concerto, which he had never considered including his repertoire. But he suddenly looked into it and said, oh, I love this piece. So he learned it in about 3 weeks. And the reason he's not doing the pre-concert lecture with us right now is he's polishing it up backstage. So
Tell us a little bit about the soloist, and have you worked with him before?
I didn't work with him before. His name is Dror, D-R-O-R, and he's on the faculty of U of L. And Lee Luvisi talked to me about him, saying, oh, he's just the greatest, he's fabulous. And so I never heard him play, but if Lee Luvisi says that somebody's fabulous, he's pretty fastidious, Lee, so that he would never waste a word like fabulous on somebody who is not. So you will enjoy the Grieg concerto, which is very similar in a way to the Schumann concerto, which he came under the influence of. I know I'm not supposed to end with a preposition, but it's late in the day. It's late in the day.
Influence.
Can't plan ahead that much. So, and so both start with a timpani kind of thing, and then this kind of rushing down. The Grieg goes bam pa pa pam pa pa pam, and the Schumann goes pa ra 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 pam pam. So, very influenced. And I think Grieg wrote it when he was 24, but underwent 7 revisions before he was really happy with it. And so this is the final version. I'm glad that he didn't live longer. He would have revised it again. You know,
he actually wrote it in Denmark, where he went, because it was warmer.
It was warmer in Denmark. Yeah, well, it's warmer now than it was then.
But he actually, didn't he study with one of Schumann's friends?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. So he was influenced by Schumann. And I have some program notes in addition to this, but I can't find them right now. And I forgot my glasses. Well, here we are. Yeah, it says, that's what it says, Schumann.
Ernst Ferdinand
the concerto
Wenzel.
Is the first piano concerto ever recorded. How do you like that? Yeah. Except that because the records were so small, they had to turn it into a 6-minute piece. So that was the first recording ever of a piano concerto. It was done in 1903. And it was recorded by Wilhelm Backhaus. When I was a little boy, they had in Mexico City a classical music station. And the way they pronounced Wilhelm was Virgen. So this is a virgin Backhaus. I never could actually picture that. I had a big problem. But now I know that whatever he was charming. And he was a great pianist. And I heard all his recordings, obviously, when I was a little kid, because that's all they played in this music station. I also have other stuff here. Oh, yeah. On April 2, 1951, the very famous Russian pianist by the name of Simon Barrère was performing this piece with the Philadelphia Orchestra and Eugene Ormandy, and collapsed and died on stage. That probably will not happen tonight.
It was the first time he was playing that piece, too.
That's right. So maybe it's fraught. It's a fraught.
And it's because he had to learn it in 3 weeks. No, that wasn't it.
That's it. And so that's the interesting stuff that we have about Again, there's also some kind of folk tunes in it. I'll bet you don't.
Well, cares? The Falling Thirds are Norwegian. That's a Norwegian folk tune.
Is it?
Idiom. Well, that's what I read.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
Do you all have any questions that you'd like to ask about the first two pieces, the composers, anything that we haven't talked about so far? This is a conversation.
Well, so far it's a two-way. I mean, it's not
a
two-way.
It's a dialogue, but we'd like to make it
a trialogue.
A trialogue, yes. Kathy?
Yes. I don't think so. I believe that I may have done it myself way back the first time I was here. I know that I did Pines of Rome here, and it could have been... See, it was a very weird orchestra when I first came, because what they did, they played all this contemporary music that was commissioned, and so they'd never played the Pastoral Symphony. They'd never played the Daphne and Chloe, Rite of Spring, all these things. In fact, when I did the Pastoral Symphony, we played the performance... And when I got to the end, you know, and I was really proud because there was no reaction from the audience. So I thought, it must have been such a profound experience for them that they didn't applaud. They just didn't dare break the spell. But after a little while, I got worried. So it's still facing the orchestra. I went like this, still no reaction. So I turned around and I said, that's it, folks. So there was this kind of embarrassed applause. So that was the first performance. But I was corrected by Bill Mutz, who said, no, it was not the first performance in Louisville because the Cincinnati Symphony had played it in 1937. But it was the first performance by the orchestra. So what I'm saying, it was a very weird experience for me to be doing all of these pieces that were standard repertory that they'd never had a chance to play because they were busy. At the beginning was 24 records a year. And that's a gigantic, you know, Rob Whitney did an unbelievable job of learning all of these commissioned pieces and putting them on record. By the time I arrived, then it became only 12 records a year. Yes, I think it was 12 records, was it? Or maybe six. I can't remember anymore. Were they bigger?
They were longer than 6 minutes.
Yeah. they were the same size. They were all, but you know, when I first arrived here, which was 1967, we were putting out the records only in mono. By that time, everybody was putting out, so it was kind of, we had a woman named Mona in the office, and her job was, she was the... money person. I mean, she did the books, but she also licked all the stamps because those records were not in general sale anywhere. You had to subscribe to get them. You had to really work hard. And so there was all of the universities had a subscription, all of the State Department offices in different countries subscribed to it. And there was a lot of really weird people who subscribed to it. There was a guy named Paul Snook who lived across the street from me on 103rd Street. And he had a garret up in his apartment. And all he had was the latest recordings off the air of pieces that had never been played before except at that moment. So he was very helpful because the recording project was called First Edition Records. We were supposed to record only stuff that was never previously recorded commercially. So he gave me a whole bunch of stuff for me to listen to and to program. So Paul Snook was one of those mysterious people that live in garrets and collect weird music.
There was another weird guy who was collecting those at that time, Max Brigado Darman. That's how he actually came to know about the Louisville Orchestra when he was growing up in Spain.
And me too. I mean, I used to go when I was a freshman at Juilliard. I used to go to the record room there and listen to this little orchestra's fantastic records. So that's how I first... So when I was invited, I don't think there was a search. In those days, nobody searched. In those days, they decided who gets the job. So I got the job, and I was really happy because I knew all about the orchestra. It was interesting. I asked one of the questions I asked, because Rudy Knorr, who was the president at that time, he was a surgeon who first convinced me to wear safety belts, because he said, as a surgeon, I can tell you, you don't look good after a crash. So Rudy Knorr and Dick Wengren, who was the manager at that time, went to New York and interviewed me. And the first question I asked is, because the riots had happened a couple of years before. And so I said,
stable?
No. Are you segregated? No, we were the first town to desegregate concerts, he said. So then I said, okay, then I'll take the job. So that's that story. And last time I told you the story about Mayor Farnsley, right?
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. Anyway, so I'm a repository of lots of history.
Well, you know, you were talking about Beethoven's Pastoral and the fact that you introduced it here with the Louisville Orchestra playing it, which is a nice segue into the Brahms Second, which is actually also a pastoral symphony.
That was really good.
That's why I'm here.
Yes, well, I have some interesting stuff about Brahms. This is something from the internet. During his teenage years, Brahms had long, fair hair, stunning blue eyes, slender waist, high voice. He could easily be mistaken for a girl. That's what it says here. Hard to believe, you know, when you see. But he was a really good-looking guy. But he was really messed up, because it took him such a long time to get over the shadow of Beethoven. So it was only late in his life that he actually decided to write the first symphony, which took him a long time. And when I studied that piece for the first time, it was amazing. He has about 20 or 30 pieces that he refers to in the symphony. So it's amazing how he's able. He was like basically a Swiss clockmaker, in the sense that he took very, very tiny little pieces of notes and build gigantic edifices. So now what happened with him is that once he got over that first hurdle, which was a tremendous hurdle, because, you know, who can write a symphony after Beethoven? And so then he started doing in pairs. So then very next year, he just kind of tossed off the second symphony, which is what we're playing tonight. Then, after a while, he did the third and fourth symphonies in a row. And was it in your program notes that Clara Schumann is quoted? Okay, I have a whole bunch of stuff. He first played the first movement and parts of the last movement for Clara Schumann. So you see the incredible way I build the program, Schumann and Grieg and then Schumann and
the Swiss
Brahms.
Clockmaker. That's where Basel comes in.
You know, I only discover how wise I am only after I've made the program. And I do the, you know, I start looking at stuff and I say, oh my God, look at that. Anyway, so she said, oh, this is much more original than the first symphony, and she predicted a more telling success for the piece. Now, it was originally scheduled to be performed on the 9th of December of 77. That's 1877. But postponed, it was postponed by the Vienna Philharmonic because it coincided with the premiere of Das Rheingold, of Wagner, who was... There were the enemy camps, you know, either Brahms was the guy of the future or Wagner was the guy of the future, but they were like cats and dogs. Now, here's something that you got to know. When Brahms finally premiered the First Symphony, you know, when you think of the First Symphony, you think gigantic, or, you know, gigantic forces. He insisted he did not want more than 10 first violins. That's 5 stands. Okay? And when he was given the opportunity in London and elsewhere, no, 5 stands is all he wanted. So these pieces are basically chamber pieces. And an incredible sound when you actually can hear all of the woodwinds. And this, it's very transparent. It's not this chocolate sauce that you usually associate with Brahms. And so we tried in this particular performance, to the extent that we could, to make it as transparent as possible. So we have, I think, the appropriate number of cellos. We have, three or four stands of cellos.
Yeah. And he uses the cellos to begin the first three movements. He uses all the strings in the fourth, but he uses the cellos
and
in each of the three movements to start it and to set the mood for that.
Right. Well, the first two are certainly the cellos in counterpoint with the bassoon, but then the last one starts with the strings in unison.
Mm-hmm.
And
he wrote this piece, has a lot of melodies that move around through the orchestra. And again, one of the things
I'm listening to what you're saying.
But it allows the conductor to have some flexibility in choosing the mood and establishing
the
mood.
Well, but the conductor has that freedom in any piece that he or she, I'm being very
But does
proper.
This piece lend itself to that? More than others?
No, I think, every piece I conduct has a million ways that, you know. And the good thing about doing this piece, this is the very first piece I ever conducted with the Louisville Orchestra. We had the first rehearsal was at Atherton. I was introduced to the orchestra by Rudy Knorr, who said, "This is George Mesher, our music director. I've never heard a bad thing about him," he said at that time. Things have changed since then, of course. And so that's the first piece. And so I remember Barbara Meek, who still is in the orchestra. And I remember what she said back in 67. She said, "You know, Mester lets us play," which is a pretty nice thing because there's a lot of conductors who are control freaks. But I'd like to think of conducting as kind of chamber music. And so and even better is that I've done this piece a lot, and I can let the intuitive part of my brain take over, so that it's the music that tells me how it goes and not the other way around. So it's always kind of fresh because I don't know which way it's going to go. And so in answer to your question, I think I try to do that with every piece. You never know what you're going to,
Mm-hmm.
It has a gigantic, fabulous horn solo at the end of the first movement, and lots of oboe. And of course, you know that Marion is retiring tonight. This is her last. I was talking to her because the Greek concerto ends in A major, and of course, the oboe gives the A to tune the orchestra. She says, "I wonder how many A's I've given in my life."
Sounds like a teacher.
Yeah.
So, any questions that have come to mind as we've been talking up here? Anything?
What is Marion going to do after
she retires? She told me she was going to have fun. One of the things that she's going to do is not make reeds. Making reeds is one of the banes of the existence of double reeds, because you have to shave them off, and then some reeds do very well in low. For example, we did Dvorak cello concerto right here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a second oboe part that plays in the very lowest of the of the register of the oboe. So he has to have a very special reed for that. And it doesn't work if you're playing high notes. So they spend most of their time, when they're not practicing, they're filing cane. So she told me, I asked her, "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to have fun."
She's going to take up fly fishing. Michael Davis can teach her.
Yeah. Yes, and you had a question. Well, the recording project was invented by Mayor Farnsley because he, I think, felt that the city needed an upgrade in its public face, because it was fast horses, fast women, and booze and tobacco, and so he and Rob Whitney got together, and so they invented this thing and they got a gigantic grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, which was the very first grant given to an American orchestra. And so that made big news that Time Magazine had a story and so on. And so it was a matching grant. I think it was a million and a half. Mm-hmm. And a matching grant in those days. So, you know, you had people at that time here that were real patrons. They commissioned composers from all over the world to write music for this size orchestra. And then it was performed and recorded. And we went to the White House. I remember playing a concert there. So in those days, nobody was recording contemporary music. And now you got millions of record labels. And so it's no longer a viable, it's not, you know, we used to get a review every few weeks from the New York Times for our recordings. One thing that I did that a lot of the weird people who subscribe to our records is that I figured, you know, it was originally invented to give composers who are still living chance to write something. But I said, you know, it's called first edition records, so I'm going to do some romantic repertoire, especially because Schoenberg, the critic from the New York Times, was pushing an idea called the Romantic Revival. And there was he organized, and we played there in Indiana, the university up there north of Indianapolis. We played two or three concerts there with romantic music. So I did the first recording of Max Bruch's First Symphony and Moskovsky Violin Concerto, and also, can you believe it, of the violin concerto by Josef Joachim, who was the man that Brahms went to for advice about the violin concerto and who wrote the famous cadenza. So a lot of people said, nah, that's not fair to have us buy records of stuff that was not written by living composers. But I think they recovered from that.
Well, we're going to let George go get dressed, but if you have any final questions.
Yes. Well, I hope you're right. I'm kind of the institutional memory of this orchestra because I remember a lot of stuff that only a couple of people in the orchestra remember who were here. But record keeping was not one of the fortes at the office. So a lot of stuff is lost. A lot of the stuff, I think, has been warehoused at U of L, I think. But, you know, the newspaper didn't even bother to say anything about tonight's concert. So I don't believe that there's much support from the newspaper here.
I don't have any control over the newspaper, but I will interview George and get this down on video, and you'll be able to find it at arts-louisville.com.
You have to wear a tie for that?
No.
Okay.
No, you don't. I'm shooting you from the neck up.
Okay.
But it will be there. I don't have any control over what the paper does.
Anybody else? That's it. No? Yes. Well, the truth is that we announced the season. That doesn't mean we'll have a sweet season. We don't know what's going to happen. The final negotiations are taking place next week. We have no idea what the judge is going to say and what the result of the negotiations is going to be. So this is a fraught time. And this may be the last concert of the orchestra. This may be. You've got to face that situation. I don't believe... I think that sports is the main preoccupation of Louisville. Yeah, and that's a fact. And I've checked this with lots of native types who have told me that I'm right. And so it's important to realize that the support that goes into building Yum Brands Hall is not bleed over into supporting the arts. And even the Fund for the Arts did not make its goal this year. So I don't know, the organizations that used to support the orchestra are gone. They no longer are here. And a lot of bequests have already been called in, and not enough people are leaving bequests these days. Everybody's much too healthy. And so there's nothing, we can't rely on bequests anymore. You know, and so I hate to leave you with this note, but that's the fact. That we don't have the support that you feel the orchestra needs. And the orchestra, I feel, has sacrificed unbelievably to serve the community. And I wish that the community could understand that, but who knows? Yes?
Isn't it the same throughout the country, the same problem?
Every town is different. This town has always, in my opinion, prided itself in the arts without actually supporting it. I'm sorry, but that's a fact. And so other towns have different histories. Maybe other towns found different ways to support their organizations without having to rely on big corporations, because other towns didn't have big corporations, so they figured different things out. But right now there's a tremendous vacuum. And even if we sold out every concert, that would only cover 33% of our budget.
But we're going to look forward to September, and we're going to look forward to having George here to talk about the Fanfara concert, and we're going to look forward to Michael Feinstein, and I will look forward to seeing all of you here for the pre-concert conversations again. Thanks for being here tonight. Thanks for this season. Enjoy the concert.
Thank you.